Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with IDF mom, Maya Zeev. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are printed in the comments below. Special thanks to Cynthia Joy, who made this episode happen.
Thank
And
you.
Thanks to my incredibly generous mom, Lenny Meyerson, for being the founding sponsor of my show. So, that being said, you could tell a lot about a person by meeting his mom. I don't know about you, but I have never had the pride and pain of sending a child off to war. Today's guest, Maya, has. And she is here to save with us, to share with us not only the overwhelming and extremely complex emotions around being an IDF parent, but also the state of a nation, Am Yisrael, how they have dealt and continue to deal with the Gaza war and all its fallout. Today, Maya and I will discuss the hope, the fear, and the raw emotions of Israel's soldiers and the families who stand behind them. If you're a yogi or a yogini who thinks the Israel Defense Forces and the State of Israel are bad actors in this war, you owe it to yourself to listen to this discussion about existential wars and why they must be fought in the battle of good versus evil, Western civilization's war on terror. Maya Zeev is an Israeli mother of three and wife to Liran. She works as a parents and couples consultant and helps people make their relationships in life better. She practices yoga, meditation, and theta healing on a daily basis and strongly believes that creating inner balance is our goal in life. This last year and a half have been the toughest years of her life, being the mother of a soldier fighting for Israel and defending his country. And this challenge was only made tougher as it forced her to face her and her husband's conscious decision in 2007 to move back to Israel from Boston and raise their American-born children as Israelis, a move that inevitably meant that all three children would eventually serve in the IDF and possibly, as is currently the case, during wartime. Timing is everything, and watching her son fight in Israel's longest and bloodiest war has changed her life forever. Maya, thank you so much for joining me and sharing with us your very personal experience.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Before we begin the broader conversation, I'd like to set the stage for our listeners. You, by profession, are a spiritual healer. I don't mean spiritual healer like a shaman, but you're spiritual and you're a healer and you bring your spirituality into your healing.
Exactly.
You're a dedicated yoga practitioner and a meditator as well. So given your deep connection to humanity, to morality, and to universe, I'm wondering, do you support Israel's war? And if so, why?
Wow, you started with a tough one. So I'll be honest and thank you. As a person, even in my regular life and relationships, I hate war and I hate fighting. So if you would ask me, if you are asking if I believe in a war, no, as a person, I don't. But I have been forced, we as a nation, as people, me as a mother, we've been forced to defend ourselves. Bad people have come into our land, into our homes, into our private homes, into our bases, and attacked us. And this has left us unprotected and violated. Women were hurt, children were kidnapped, men were kidnapped, died. There was no other reason. We are waking up on that morning. I'm telling my husband, it's a Bollywood movie. No way, honey. Sorry, because of the color of the people, I was sure this is a movie. And Liran is like, honey, it's the news. It took me 2 full minutes. I was like, that my brain is understanding it is a war. I believe in protecting yourself. I believe in saving your own people. And unfortunately, in the last year and a half, this war is what we get in order to protect ourselves. And I'm going to be honest again and say that people think we are fighting one angle of a war, the Gaza war. We are at war. We are in Gaza war, on Lebanon war, on Syria war, Iran war, Yemen war. And that's even a few seconds before you start on the emotional war and over the economical situation. So let's be honest, it is a war. I do not support it. I want it to end. I pray daily, not only for my son's health or his friends, for the war to be over, for the people to be back with us, for the survivors and the dead to be back, so we can start back the peace. There is no, in my opinion, there is no any purpose for staying at war.
I agree that in a war, and particularly a war that has been forced upon Israel, and that is in fact a war on terror, that I think that what people sometimes in, like, let's say in the yoga community, that is a peace-loving community, don't understand that a sad necessity of life, unfortunately, that sometimes war is required in order to establish peace. And there seems to be this blank check, either you support war or you support peace. And this just simply doesn't in any way address the nuanced reality that when you have terrorists at your gates, there literally is no choice if you want to protect your nation. I think people don't even understand how much Israel's doing right now to protect, in fact, the world.
I think we are dealing with the need of protection. And on the night that we're witnessing our own soldiers, it was around 3 weeks after the invasion to Israel, after October 7th,
mm-hmm.
We went in Gaza territories looking for our people. The war has been changed. Sorry again, because anytime we started getting close to our people, they are starting to kill our people.
Listen,
so we have no other way.
Maya, we need to be clear for anybody who's listening, because I know what you're talking about, but not everybody knows that when you say your people, you're speaking specifically about the
hostage. About the hostage, about the people kidnapped, staying. That's what our army was looking for originally. We went in for our people. Don't take our people. We're not going to be in your land. We don't care. We do what? You know what? The people... I don't live in the south of Israel. I live middle Israel, a little bit up to the north. But the people living on that area are not people looking for fighting. They are agriculture people. They are land and soil people.
Mm-hmm.
Daddy Moses, that was just released this week, told his kidnappers, one day, when there's gonna be peace, I'm gonna be back here teaching you how to work your lands. That's what's going on in our news. Those people weren't looking for attacking Gaza people. Our army was sitting there protecting us. You can see the extent of the damage. Because our army wasn't attacking anybody. It was Sabbath morning. It was a holy day. We weren't doing anything. we were guarding our own people. So that's my reality facing that moment.
Yeah, and it is a very complex reality. And I do want to get into Israeli values, because it's a very important point that, again, people, when all they get is what they see in the media, do not understand what Israeli values really are. I'm going to get into that, but I want to lay some more foundation. Before we get in specifically to the conversation about you, about your son, about your family, can you tell us about your personal, your husband's connection to Israel being at war, and how that might change the dynamic a little bit? Because one thing people don't really understand in America is basically, and I say basically, there are of course exceptions, basically everyone in Israel is a veteran, wherein in America, hardly any of us even know anybody who's ever served. I mean, it's a completely different mindset. People do not understand the dynamics of war, the reality of war, and how it affects society. So
I will start from a different issue. You know, our land as a country, as a nation, is 76 years old. We are a land of 20, I don't know, 2,000 years, but we have 76 years of independence. And this means that we count wars in the last 76 years. We had like 5 or 6 wars. Each war was a few days, except for our biggest war. It was Yom Kippur War. It was 3 weeks. It was, if I'm not mistaken, 2,500 people were dead, soldiers. But it didn't come to the civilians, to the men and the women and the children in the houses. It was the soldiers fighting, soldiers against soldiers, armies against armies. And we're all veterans because this nation is so young. Everybody has somebody who fought one of the wars, because we are a nation. Everybody serves the country. If you are secular, if you are religious to a certain extent, a really small group is excluded. This is a different story, whether it's right or wrong, but I'm not going into it now. We all serve the country. We all, women and men, I give 2 years, and men would give 3 years. So everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows somebody that was fighting a war. That's why everybody is a veteran. In my personal story, as a child, my family, we served the army, but the army wasn't a big part of my culture. Do your 2 years. I have an older brother. He did his 3 years. My father did. Do your thing and go back to work. It's an episode like high school. Like my husband's life, it's a different story. My husband was born in the early winter, January 73. Israel Yom Kippurim War is October 73. Okay, 50 years before the 7th of October of 2023. And my husband's father was a high commander in the army. He was working in the army. He wasn't like the 3 years serving the army. He was a high commander. The war started. It was Yom Kippur. He was in Bet Knesset praying. He had to leave the house, kissed his baby, my husband, said goodbye, and left. At around 10 or 12 midnight, he came back, asked to go and kiss the baby. The baby stood up in his bed. He gave him a kiss. He said bye-bye. And he never came back. He died 2 hours before the end of the war, between the 2 hours of the C-section, of the P sections. He was waiting. He was the front line. down in the south. He was the highest commander. He was standing out of his, bye honey, out of his vehicle, a little thing down his neck, 1 second, and he was out. And my husband was an orphanage when he was 10 months old. And that's his story of life. He was raised by his mother, who was remarried, and he was adopted by an amazing father that raised him. And he has two other sisters. And this is a family that you see that the army was a big part of their life. And grief became a big part of their life. I've been dating my husband since I'm 21. I have it in my heart and my soul, the story. When I married my husband, when I was carrying Ben in my stomach, knowing Ben is a male, my firstborn, Ben, I asked my husband, can we name him second name after your father? Your father will always guard him. Wherever he will walk, your father will bless him. And I really do believe that there is a big reason why my firstborn chose to be a fighter. You can be a soldier. You don't have to be a fighter. He has this inner need to be in the front lines. He's saying to me, that's my job. That's my responsibility. Who's going to protect you? This is my job. And I think he has it from us, but he has it through a passage from a different generation, from another world. That's how I look at it, if you ask me, spirituality. So we are a family that we don't need Yom HaZikaron, the Memorial Day, for memory.
Right.
I will tell you that my husband is 100% replica of his father. He was 9 months old. He cannot mimic face motions and hand motions. There weren't movies. He has only pictures. So that's our story. It's embedded, the war and the danger and the sacrifice and the belief of the good of this country. And that's our family.
Yeah, it's so devastating. And in later in the show, I do want to talk about the broader implications of war beyond just, you know, the statistics, which is all we really get in the news, because they run so deep. And to say that that war runs in the blood, it's not in a way that war mongering. It's in a way that
protection runs in the blood, not war. Protection.
Yeah. We share the responsibility of protecting our nation. That's really so touching in emotional for me. And I think that it actually begins to sort of drive the answer to my next question. So we're gonna go backwards in time, and then we'll come back to today. So in the early 2000s, you're an Israeli living in Boston. You're raising a family far from home. And in 2007, you and your husband decided to move back to Israel. Your son was 4 at the time, and you knew that returning to Israel meant that he and your other children would all have to serve and potentially risk their lives in the IDF after high school. This is a time frame that, like, it just seems like the blink of an eye to any loving parent. So, Maya, how close was this thought of your children having to serve, possibly having to serve in combat? How close was it to the forefront of your mind when you made this life-changing decision to move back to Israel?
It didn't even cross my mind. It's not close, because it wasn't even in my brain. And I'm going to be really honest. This is like one of the frequent questions that I've been asked from people, but honestly, mainly in the last year and a half, and not in the last almost 20 years that I live back in Israel in the last 18 years. So the question is, why does people ask it now? And I will answer it. When you tell me that I would go back to Israel and you would tell me about serving the army, I would say, of course, it's just like you're going to ask me, are you going to celebrate the holidays? Of course. Are you going to see the sun? Of course. Are you going to visit the ocean? Of course. Okay. We live in Israel. We serve the army. But my army, the one that was in my brain, how close was it? So I'll tell you what was in my brain. Serving the army like serving the office. The option of having a war like the 73 war, the Yom Kippur war, wasn't crossing my mind, not for a second. And I wonder, if I did, what would I think? Because if you ask me now, I have two more children going to serve the army. My daughter is going to enlist in 6 months, to be honest, five, if we want to be correct. She is chosen for a really important job in the intelligence, and she's going to protect and fight through the office. That was my thought for my older son. It never crossed my mind the other side of the genetic. And I'll be honest, I did raise my children for doing the best you can and giving your maximum. And when he became around 17 years of age, he comes home with a song that I did not sing for him. I sang, or I, as we say, I breastfeed him to be a good person. And he came from his friends, what he brought home. The music was, I'm going to be a fighter. And I'm like, what? What about the office? No, 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 mommy. I'm going to be a fighter. I'm like, no, honey. People who fight, they lose their life. He's like, no, mommy. Grandpa lost his life. Everybody is alive. I'm going to come back. I'm going to. It was 2 years before the war that he had set his mind and put his goals. That's why I said it's a different song. I didn't sing this song. I sang a different song. I sang the office song. And when you have a child being raised in Israel, what they push each other is how meaningful your service is going to be. What are you going to do for your country? What's your qualities as a person? And he's standing in front of me and said, I'm really smart, mom, but I'm really strong.
Yeah.
And they need us, the young, strong men. And I encourage mom, and we're going to do it. You look at it and I'm like, that's not my song that I gave you, that I sang to you. No, honey, that's the wrong song. Go sing. You can't go against a 17-year-old and tell him that you raised him to love your country. So in the last 2 years, before the army, I already knew I'm having a soldier who is going to be a fighter. Yeah. And he did everything within his power to be accepted to those, to this elite unit that he's in. This was his dream. And then he's been accepted. And in my brain, maybe it's going to be easy. Maybe it's going to be. Okay. And then starts the war. And then we're facing this reality. Yeah. Okay. He chose a really, really dangerous path. And this child is really important. So you have mixed feelings. It's really dangerous. And you're really proud.
Of course. And it's interesting that you would say that, like, the mother's milk was the milk of, like, an office job. But then you also say that he previously that the warrior was always in his blood. And so these are the lions of Israel. But let me go back even further. Okay. Because I'm going to assume he had like a typical Israeli childhood. And many people by now have seen how like the people of Gaza indoctrinate their children from birth, not just to hate, but to literally slaughter Jews wherever they could find them. It's in the UNRWA textbooks, as well as in their mass media. They use Sesame Street style puppets and cartoons to glorify terrorism and martyrdom as the ultimate goal in life.
But
So,
this is not the way Israeli children have been raised.
my question is, what is preschool like in Israel? And at what age do children in Israel even learn about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and how is it generally presented to them?
I think you're going to be shocked for my answer. I'm going to start from the upper age and go down. It is forbidden in the army to speak about your opinion of right-wing, left-wing, for the Arab people, against the Arab people. It is forbidden. You're in the army, it's a closed subject. One stage before would be high school. It's an open subject because we have one subject, like you have math and you have English, we have Israel democracy. And you have to go into a test for that in your application. So in high school, it is open subjects, not terrorism. We're not educating them against the subject for talking is open. It's not in the books. Look, Arabs are bad people. No. We talk about the conflict openly in high school. Middle school. I have a child in middle school. Middle school, you must learn Arabic. It's a mandatory language for minimal 2 years.
Wow.
7th grade and 8th grade. All my children learned Arabic in school. They have to. Do you think we do it in order for them to then kill them? No, we do it for communication. We do it because we have a lot of Israeli Arabs living in Israel, living among us, living with us, selling the stores, and we talk and we are neighbors. Where I live, a lot of Arabic villages around. So we teach our children, because we live in the center of Israel, to be together. And that's Israel school system. Elementary school, no one speaks about this conflict. And preschool, whatever the ages, no. So
There's no indoctrination at all. And I know that the indoctrin when it comes to what is taught to the younger generations in Israel is just about pride and defending a nation. It's never about terror or martyrdom. But so you're saying it really starts preschooler, there's none, elementary school, none, middle school,
middle school, learn Arabic so you will have the opportunity to communicate. High school, operate your own opinion. Start making your own options because when you're 18, you're supposed to vote. So you need to understand because this is deep in our parliament, this dispute. And then at 18, you have to serve. But you weren't serving against. You were serving for. That's the way. And in my son's experience as a soldier, it's a fighting time. So everything is mixed up. Is how do you, and I have my son is saying, Mom, when we fight, we see civilians, we see families, we have orders, clear orders. We keep them safe. Of course, there might be mistakes. I'm sorry. I'm sure. Like there are mistakes that people on our side are hurt. But as a general experience, they also from the army get really clear notion of, well, you do not come for a mass murder, you come to protect.
Yeah, absolutely. When the IDF trains its soldiers, I mean, there's a vast focus that I don't know that any other military has on morality, integrity, and even Jewish values. I don't know if it, because I've seen a lot about it online, and I don't know if that's evolved over time or how deeply you understand what goes on with that kind of training. But can you tell us a little bit about the training and reinforcement of the IDF, specifically when it comes to the IDF code of conduct?
What do you mean, code of conduct?
Like what you're saying about protecting civilian lives, and that because
I give you, for example, I don't know the word of it in English, but there is a little stopper, a red, like my color, a little red stopper in the rifle. There is a law that when you're on Israeli soil, and even now in Syria, which is a protected soil, you have to have this stopper. Why do you have the stopper? So there wouldn't be even a mistake of something happening, because when you are on a safe territory, you're not in an attack position. The way that they teach them, and that's why other nations use children and women to protect themselves. They teach our soldiers, when there is a child or a woman, you cannot fire. What are the other side doing? Bringing human shield just for that. So we as a nation are having a big issue with mistakes, because we have clear rules what is not supposed to be done and what is supposed to be done. And our soldiers don't spend their days picking on people. You can see lines of civilians being walking. You know, a few months ago they were walking down, and hopefully this week they started walking up. You see our soldiers standing on the sides and protecting that. No fires, no humiliations, no laughing on people. You would see Israeli army soldiers picking up stuff, helping them, because they understand the humanity. Those people don't have homes. Those people are suffering the results of what we're suffering on our side of the borders. They're suffering because we are strong army that have destroyed their home. We are not going to destroy their pride.
That's beautiful. And it's such a stark contrast to what we've seen with these hostage releases that have been just such an abomination. How Hamas has been intimidating and humiliating our hostages, even as they're being released. You don't see any of that coming from the Israelis.
I'm going to ask you if you heard on the Arab side TV, when they were waiting last week, they were waiting for Israel to open Netzarim. And Israel wasn't opening it.
Just really quickly, so because not everybody...
There was an issue with one of the hostages. So the Arab people are asking, who is this woman? Why does all the nations stand behind her? We stand behind humanitarian. The women, this one woman counts as a country for us. The minute they let her go, they freed a full nation coming up. We look at one person as a nation, and other countries don't look at that. And that's the humanity of our soldiers. They see one child, or one man, or one woman. They seize their fire first. And that's why we sometimes get hit,
yeah,
because of this thing.
So I before I get into sort of the sticks on this, I just want to ask one more question about being a child in Israel. I don't even know how if this is something that could really be answered, but at what age do you think Israeli children realize they're gonna have to serve in the military? And what kinds of questions and emotions come up for them when they do?
It's obvious to them, like the air that they breathe. So they grow up into it because it's out in the open as a conversation. So there isn't an age. And I can tell you that in the last 2 years, being a soldier became much more popular, not only at customs at our Halloween is Purim. At our holiday of custom, being a soldier is actually being a hero. So, as a child, that's the way usually children look at. And then, when you become a teenager, that's when you usually separate. This is where you build your own opinions. You either decide you're going to be the best soldier you're going to be, or you said, I'm going to do the simple, easy little job. Finish with that, or even get off the hook and find myself. So it's like breathing. You know, you're gonna breathe at the age of 18, okay? It's normal. It's not even a question here.
So you have three children. At no point when one of them was 5, 7, 9 years
No.
old, they didn't ask any questions or express any fears or.
No. My children were like, when my fighter son, when my 20-year-old son was 8, he was introduced with cooking and he loved cooking. So he said, I'm going to be a cook in the army. And then when he was 15, he was dreaming about being a driver. Yeah. So what I'm going to be in the army? I'm going to be a driver. Okay. When he became 17, he understood the war. He understood the world. Sorry. He understood his body, understood his character. And he said, I'm going to be the best warrior I can be. I'm going to be a tough soldier. I'm going to be an elite. And I'm like, what? Okay. And I'm like, okay, he wanted to be a cook. He wanted to be a driver. Maybe he could pass this kid.
So
Didn't.
I understand. They don't see it any differently, as you mentioned in the very beginning than going to high school or going to the beach. It just is, and
I
it
will tell you
doesn't
something. Not everybody in the States goes to college. So it's a question, when do you,
matter.
in Israel, everybody goes to the army. So when are you going to go to high school? Everybody goes to high school after the end of the sixth grade or the ninth grade. Got it. It's the same.
Interesting. Okay. I really want to clarify for listeners because I think that people don't, especially people who have never been to Israel and only get their information from the mass media, there's been so much false equivalence, dangerous equivalence attributed to the people of Israel and of Gaza. On the international and diplomatic scale, the ICC has made the grotesque equivalence between Benjamin Netanyahu, a democratically elected head of state, and Yahya Sinwar, one of the most infamously nefarious terrorists that used to walk this earth. The strategically deceitful media has often conflated innocent Israeli hostages, such as now 2-year-old Kfir Bibas and 86-year-old Shlomo Mansour, with terrorist felons who are serving multiple life sentences for massacring masses of Jews. People don't understand how vastly different these two value systems really, really are. So, on a more granular and human level, while the internet is filled with Gazan mothers who call sacrificing their own children, their babies, as martyrs, as being the greatest honor on earth, you would never see an Israeli mother saying the same. Maya,
Never.
what is the difference between a Gazan mother who martyrs her own child and an Israeli mother who consciously sends hers off to war?
First of all, I can't understand her, the Gazan mother. I just can't, because if I'm gonna put someone in danger, it would be myself. If someone has to be in danger here, someone has to take one for the team, it will be me. Or of course, me and my husband, or my husband is okay, not never my children. Second, as a nation, we are so much busy in building. We are 76 years old. We're young in the nation world. We are trying to be a capital of startup. We're trying to build our nation. We don't take our energy for our children into killing other people. When we teach them that they're serving the army, and when I went back to Israel knowing that they were going to serve the army, it was a protection kind of war. Let's be honest, Greece for a second, a country that lives in peace with Turkey, still has mandatory army. Men in Greece serve 1 year and they must do it. So for me, it looks natural. We, the mothers, I'll sacrifice myself and not my son. I can't understand. I can't speak for them. I can't compare any of our rulers to their rulers. I can't compare their actions. I can't compare their reactions. I can't compare their history. And one of them doesn't have a future. So I will say I can also cannot compare their future. So not the present. We are surrounded with nations that do not share our honest belief. And I think this is our main issue. I'm not trying to understand the other nation or the other mothers or the toy, the most popular toy in Gaza stores before Gaza was destroyed was a missile chamber. The child and our main toy is phone, a mimic phone. Children the age of 3 want to be like their parents. That's my profession. They look, they mimic, they want to be like. So Israeli children want bicycle, want cars, and want phones, like the American children at Toys R Us. In the story or the Amazon. In Gaza, they buy mimic, not a house, and they do bombing. And that's a huge difference with the toys, with the books. And the problem is, our problem is not the Arab nations, but the Arab people look at us as their problem. So there is a huge difference in mentality, in values, in future plans, and in education.
Sure, and it's funny. I mean, anybody who's been to Israel or been to a synagogue or has any interaction with Jews, if there's one word that people know in all of Hebrew, it's shalom. And if there's
And
one
it means so much. One
word.
word of shalom means so much.
It does mean so much. I don't want to get, I've actually done like entire conversations on this word, but it also, one of the things, I'm just going to leave it at this, means peace. It is such a prevalent word in Jewish and Israeli society. I mean, the first thing you see when you get off the plane, or when you get to any border in Israel is Shalom Aleichem. Well, welcome to all who come. And so that is the word. And then if you ask people the one word that they know from, I'm going to say Islam, and I mean radical Islam, but the one word, it's usually jihad right now. And there's a lot to be said for understanding like this difference that even though it may be the same physical war that we're fighting two very, very, very different battles. So I want to get into the actual your son's experience in the war a little bit, because it will give us some better context for getting into your experiences as an IDF mom. So October 7th, right, 2023, as you mentioned, your son was still in basic training. And
He was
though
really fresh in the army, yeah.
though it may seem otherwise from abroad, combat is not inevitable for all who serve in the IDF. On October 6th, there was no indication that your son's service would be anything other than routine, but 2 months later, as a new soldier, he found himself in full combat. And it's hard to imagine a young boy with hardly any training at all going into battle in what every war expert has deemed the most complex urban warfare landscape in history. Israel has never.
I'll tell you what Israel did, which was very smart because we didn't have time, Shana. We were on a verge of a breakdown. So we had who were able to fight, and they trained them for 2.5, maybe 3 months. What they did, they took out everything that would be the crème de la crème. Whatever that is not necessary for war, move aside. Whatever is, let's say, physical to walk the land or walking distance. No, fighting, you go on a car, you go on the big cars, they were shooting. They did quick and really intensive. We couldn't speak to them. And whenever they were calling us, they were saying we're somewhere and we're practicing hard. The minute when they were prepared, Israel needed them. And I'm sure that my son, it's not, he's not an only child. There is the whole nation is enlisting in dates. They have dates that they know in advance. So in this month or so, in this quarter of a season, they had prepared them all really quick. They didn't use them all. And I will tell you that my son will say, we are the fortunate ones that have been used very efficiently. Because for a young man, an Israeli young man serving the country, the question has been, what have you've been done? What you've been doing for your country? I'll tell you that in the last time that my son was home, he was having his friends here for coffee outside, and I sat with them. And one of the boys, he's 25, he finished the army a long time ago, and he said, I was wounded, and until today, I regret I didn't do what you guys have the chance now to do. For them, they are writing history and they're making a difference. And any person in life wants to be important. And that's what they feel. For me, it's endless hours of praying to God for protection, not for winning, for protection. I always look at it from a protection point of view.
Sure. One of the most famous quotes of modern history in America was from JFK when he said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I want to point out the startling difference between American youth who these days are most often characterized by their sense of entitlement, versus literally expecting everything to be done for them, versus what you're saying about the young Israeli experience, which is to see what they can give back. And it's such a beautiful and respectable viewpoint on living, because it's not just living for yourself. It's living to serve your people, your nation, your family, and it's
I'll be honest and say, as a mother, I'm not making it pink, okay? I'm gonna be honest. I'm sure that before this war happened, a person who is around 17, 18, okay, like my son and my daughter, knowing that they're going to serve the army, they're going to say, oh, I have to give 3 years. Oh, I can't run with my life, okay? Let's deal with it. Let's do it. Let's do it fun. Let's do it important. But this war had changed each and every one of the Israeli people living here and away. All the Jewish people don't have to be Israeli. Your heart is torn for your country, for your people. So being an Israeli, living here, seeing it, having people you know that were at the party, having people you know living in those kibbutzes, that's what changed those young people saying those sentences from the heart. If they didn't see the results, the bad influence of hatred, I'm not sure that those young people are going to speak differently than the American children, because it's mostly really close.
Sure. And even on October 7th, the fact that 150% showed up for service, meaning more than even were called up, showed we were at something of a crisis, really, because of the judicial reform stuff, where people in society were saying they weren't going to serve and reservists weren't going to show up. And then here comes a war and everybody's like,
everybody,
what can
everybody.
I do?
I'm going to ask you a question. There's another difference that I don't know if you ever thought about. Did you think about the location of the war as an impact? Because in my opinion, it has an impact, and I will explain. Let's say the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War is thousands of kilometers. It's not in your backyard or in your front yard, which basically what happened to us. Second, not everybody is sending somebody to the Vietnam War. Everybody has a 100% connection for this war. We are a small country. The missiles are attacking 70% of the country. Up north, one war. Down south, another war. We're all in it. If you're not there, you're not there. So Israel as a nation is protecting herself.
Yes, the location is very important, but I would argue that, and a lot of people are using the Vietnam analogy, particularly in response to the level of unrest that it caused on college campuses. I don't want to get into that right now.
No, me neither. I'm just saying this is far away, and this is in our, it's like New York is invading Massachusetts, okay? It's in your backyard. It's there. And everybody in Massachusetts is involved. We're the size of Rhode Island. We're small.
I understand that. The point that I wanted to make is that it would be more, same as that concept, but more appropriate to compare it to the war on terror that followed 9/11, when they actually did invade America, when they actually did kill 3,500 approximately people. But again, like, because of the proximity, the war in Israel, it's an existential war, wherein the American war on terror was more, in this is going to sound like a bad thing, and I don't think it's a bad thing, but it was more a war of revenge. You do this to us, you're going to pay the price. But in Israel, people do not understand that when you have terrorists on every border. And I do say every border. I'm sorry when people are like, oh, but you have peace with Egypt and you have peace with Jordan. Okay. There's terrorists on every border. Hard stop. It's the end of story. And people cannot understand what that means for a tiny country to be encroached upon by the Arab world that is 500 times larger. 500 times in any direction. You're talking about people who want to destroy you. And without that context, there's no way for people to really fully understand the discussion at all. So Anyway, Maya, I actually, interestingly enough, the reason why we're having this conversation in the first place was to actually get a little bit into who you are and what your experience has been like as a mom, as a conscientious human. So, again, I've never sent a child to war. I can only imagine what this experience has been like for you and your husband. And you're both IDF veterans, so you guys have, again, like this unique perspective that American does not have. Sending your beloved child to war with no knowledge from day to day where he is or what he's doing, facing brutally ruthless terrorist enemies. I know that the fear of death is everywhere, and I have to assume that basic things like sleep become an absolute luxury for you. Can you tell us a little bit, Maya, about the complex emotions? We started touching upon it, this dizzying swirl of pride and anguish that you've been experiencing this last 16 months.
So I'll tell you that I feel as a person that I lost, let's say there are like 400 different emotions. I lost 300 of them. I had fear and anxiety and worry and anxious and cry and hope. Maybe like 10 emotions, everything. And to be honest, it's a process diffusing it when your son is coming back home. It's sending him, it's holding it. And when they come home, the change process in order to go back to your life. I had an honest conversation with my aunt the other day, and I said, I think we're really, really just starting now. And it is an ability that is getting better because of the hostages coming back. So it's all connected with the war and the hostages together. So about the emotions. Basically, you stop feeling anything because your brain cannot hold two thoughts at one time. And there is one dominant thought. Our life, it's the end of the world as we know it. That's the song that was running in my head all the time. It's the end of the, it might be the end of the world as I know it. Someone is gonna get killed. And you're worried for your son, you're worried for his friends because it's a chain, because if something happens to them, then his soul is destroyed, and then it's like a house of cards. Everything is gonna fall. So basically, and wherever you turn around, then you have this friend and that friend, and her son is doing that, and her daughter is doing that, and everybody, it's like a pandemic, it's like the coronavirus. You're gonna get close, you're gonna get hooked. And I think that what I had to do as a person is to figure out how I deal with it, because I'm a person that works with emotions. And my job is to give my heart and my brain to other people. How can I give you my heart and my brain when I don't have them? When they have been kidnapped by my anxiety. So I have been challenging my thoughts and my emotions and my energy into good things. I was talking to the moon. I was using the moon. I was believing that the moon is gonna send the same moon that you can see from my window. It's tougher to look at the sun. Someone asked me, why aren't you looking at the sun? I said, because the sun is, you can't see the circle, but when you see the moon, you actually see the moon. So I was talking to the moon, take it to him. So that was the beginning. The beginning, I was clueless. I had nothing to hold on, and I had to be the mom, meaning there are other children in this house. There are grandmothers in this family. There is a dead grandfather, but there is an adoptive grandfather who is raising his child and his child. There is a tough emotional situation. And what we basically did is practice all the time, either body, either soul. But the emotions are basically don't let them run you. That's like the beginning, they ran me. I wasn't running. I wasn't in charge of my own thoughts. Everything, I'll give you a story. I went into a yoga session and I asked my son, it's an hour. Will you still be in Israel when I'm done? He said, yes, mommy, we're here probably until 9. I finish my yoga. I go out. I take my phone and I see a message, Mom, I love you. We go in. Even now, when I just said it to you, I had, like a heat wave in my body. I can't even tell you about that moment. How I had to pick myself up in order knowing that this is, it's like going into a dive without saying good luck. It's the thought that, God forbid, if something is happening, I didn't say goodbye. And if something will, you start running in circles like a mouse in your own brain. After one circle of fighting and another circle of fighting, you become an expert mother and you're starting to make your own rules. If you can find that, send me that. If someone here knows my number, give me this. And then slowly, 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 in the operation of the army, order started to go into this war. And food was coming in and food was coming out and information was coming in and information was coming out. And we don't live from the news. We're waiting for information. And I realized that information helps me control my emotions. So if you ask me, I have been all my life best friends of emotions, but in the last 2 years, I have reconnected or I reacquainted with emotions that I really don't want to have them in my life in such an intense sensitivity. So I have became an expert in not muting, but dimming. I like the word dimmer. Like, oh, I don't like the light. Can you make it dimmer? I dimmer my emotions and I practice it because otherwise, no, you talk to me about sleeping, napping, resting, being able to lie down. It's a challenge because you can't, you have to move, you have to move your body needs to take out the stress all the time. That's the emotional situation.
Interesting. So being a yoga instructor myself and in my audience, obviously being a lot of yoga people, this is Yoga Athletica. I assume that the physical movement in conjunction with the spiritual practice of yoga has helped you to cope from day to day or minute to minute, really. So can you go over a bit about like the coping, the specific coping mechanisms, the practices that you have been employing, and in just in general, like how do you and all the mothers of the IDF like stay so strong?
I'll tell you a story. I started practicing in a yoga place for women, which is really close by here. And I come for the first time and I'm alone. I do my class with a teacher. I come on the second, I say hello to a woman. We start practicing. She doesn't speak at all. Just hello in the beginning and hello in the end. Really, just the two of us practicing, 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 practicing. She doesn't speak. I don't know her. She doesn't speak. After 2 months, I meet this woman in a bar mitzvah. And everybody kisses her. And I have no idea who she is. And I start hearing everybody whispering. So I go and say, what are you whispering? And they say, she's the mother of this, this, this. It's a soldier who died. I figured out after 3 months that my practice mate, who doesn't say anything except for hello and goodbye, is dealing. I am crying my eyes in my yoga, not looking what's happening on her mat because it's just the two of us and she's not speaking at all. Now I understand her challenge on her mat. So that's my early stages of practicing yoga around this war. Her son died October 7 on that day. He was an angel. And she's a really, really strong woman. So I'll tell you my story with the yoga. When I started yoga 2.5 years ago, I couldn't do anything, not even the warrior. I couldn't do like the simplest one. I didn't have one muscle in my body. I was weak and I'm thin and weak. So I started practicing and doing, okay, Chaturanga, don't even try. I'm really, really good. Like my favorite was child pose and rest pose. Sometimes I can do the mountain. Okay, or the tree. That's it. I couldn't do anything that the muscle should hold. The first time I came to yoga when the war started, I suddenly could. I could breathe. I started having successful feelings. I could breathe for a full hour. I could cry. No one would ask me why. And I was able to do most of the things that I wanted. I didn't do the full class in the beginning, but I was able. And I said to myself, I can't control my feelings. I can't sleep. I can't eat. The first thing for me, I stop eating. I can't this, but that I can. And I went the next day. And again, I could do it. And my controlling or ability or deeming, which would be basically adding, was through the yoga. And it strengthened both my soul, my body, my belief in myself. Because in yoga, there is nothing you should do. You should do, my teacher is saying, go to your 80% and then make your decision. I didn't have 80% then. I didn't have anything. But whenever I started, I succeed. They just asked me to breathe. I just have to do down dog. One step at a time. It gave me a feeling if I had survived this hour, I can survive the next hour. And one step at a time. So that's my early yoga experiences with the war. I think I am, until today, really thankful for my teacher saying that we are at war, everyone. She's opening the doors for everybody to come. She didn't ask, and I didn't think, do I have a time? We didn't have life. We didn't do anything. And for 1 hour, I could. And until today, meditation and yoga would be my safe place when I'm in good shape and when I'm in a tough spot.
It's amazing because it sounds like, in a way, the war empowered your yoga, while at the same time, in this interesting symbiosis, your yoga also empowered you to deal with the war.
Perfect analogy, because if I can do that, then I can deal outside too.
Yes.
And I would sit hours and meditate in pieces. And when I would meditate sometimes, I would say, okay, choose one pose. Take one pose that you wanna feel that you can. So in my opinion, it became my safe place really early. because I had the feeling that I can't do anything except for sitting and worrying. What I wasn't doing when I was yoga, when I was meditating or practicing, is worrying. Not that I would forget for 1 second that he is a danger, but I could hold the worry with something else. And that was an amazing feeling that I wanted to duplicate, because it made me feel alive and able to hold it.
Absolutely. Just as an aside, because again, I think that there's a lot of misconception about shared values and just how the high moral standards that are held by Israelis. I just as an aside want to point out to our listeners. So I personally spend a tremendous amount of time in Israel, though I live in Los Angeles. And two things people who have never visited Israel probably don't know is, first of all, that Israel and Tel Aviv in particular has one of the most thriving and passionate yoga communities on earth today. And
all over the country, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But when you're in Tel Aviv, everyone has the yoga mat, just like in Los Angeles, just walking around. And I teach at various studios around the country. So I have a good sense of like how it compares to other countries on earth. It's so deeply embedded. And even the religious people will have like religious women's Jewish yoga. It's such a big part of yoga and Israeli society. And you have to understand that that consciousness, that conscientiousness carries over and blends very, very, very seamlessly with Jewish values. Also, another thing that's interesting, Israel also happens to have the most vegans per capita than any other nation. I mean, this is such a deeply spiritual place, even beyond any attachments to formal religion. In fact, my sister and I, last April 2024, volunteered for a week. Are you familiar with Achim Yoga, Brothers in Yoga?
So they support people that have trauma. I read about them. There are men in Israel, most of them.
There's many organizations doing this same thing, which is nonprofits that are helping soldiers and reservists cope with their PTSD through yoga and meditation. So for those who are so quick to judge what they believe Israeli society to be because they happen to be in a war, you have to understand that if you believe in the precepts of yoga, then you have the exact shared values as the people in Israel. So Maya, you touched upon actually a lot in the last few minutes about this fear, right? That will always follow knowing that you have a son at war. I can't imagine
a mother still carry this fear even now.
Sure.
They don't come home at night. They serve the army. We have less, open agendas, because now the Yemen don't fire on us. We're now in kind of a safe section with Iran, right. Kind of a safe section with Lebanon, and kind of a, okay. But my son is in a elite unit.
Right.
He sits on the borders serving his country. So I have to deal with this fear on a daily basis. Just the country doesn't deal with that with me anymore, because most of the mothers' sons are either regular soldiers, or if they are in reserves, and we had this war, we had to use the reserve people a lot. Most of the reserve people are home now. So out of the people who are being in the war, who is now still at the war, is the soldiers who are doing the 3 years mandatory service and the high commander. And I belong to the unit. Right. My son is, as we say, halfway. He did half of his service and he has another half. I wish that the second half is going to be less challenging, that I can go back to being, that's a humor word, but that I can go back being a mother of three and not a mother of one, with the attention that this war is taking. It's taking the whole family, not just me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to ask a question. I literally have no idea what your answer is. No idea. But I'm going back to these very human fears. One of my favorite quotes is that fear is faith in the negative. And I know that fear is inescapable in a situation like this, but at the same time, I feel like you're somebody who also carries a tremendous amount of faith. And when I say faith, I don't necessarily mean religious faith, but it can be that too. I'm just wondering what role, I know the role that fear is playing in your life. What role is faith playing to maintain your strength right now?
Actually, in my opinion, it's like the remedy for the pain is hope. The only way I know how to deal with anxiety, fear, sleepless nights, bad thoughts, tough emotions, or as I told you, having the feeling that I can't, that I won't be able to hold it. That's what happened to me. The only way to deal with it is hope. And if you ask me how I raise my hope, so I can't say we're seculars, though you see I don't have a hair cover and I'm wearing pants, but I'm a really, really spiritual person. I believe in God. I believe God is protecting my child. We bless as a family for Shabbat. I light the candles and then we eat whatever we want to eat. And we do drive and light the fire. So we have our way with, not that we're not Jewish, we're all Jewish, but the way we practice Judaism. But to be honest, in my house, we really practice belief in three different ways. Both my husband and I, we go in through the Buddhistic way in the last 14 years.
Okay.
So Buddhism and Judaism are really, really, really close, and they really get along. We tend to joke that the only mistake for Buddha is that he couldn't find God, that God found God before him. Okay, so I practice meditation and good positive thinking and helping people and controlling my thoughts as a remedy for my faith. And few years ago, I was introduced through my being a therapist. I do family constellation. I use other spiritual methods. And then I was acquainted with a method called Theta Healing. And I'll tell you what I practice it daily. I work with it and I practice it. And I tell you why I love it so much. Because Theta Healing connects you to the universe. It doesn't connect you to God as being your religious God, but it connects you to a higher God that, it's a translation from Hebrew, that only loves you and only wants to give you. So if I look at this God, and I am a child of God, and I am in danger, because my brain and my soul is saying to me that I'm in danger because my son is in danger, then I practice belief in bigger values, bigger picture, that everything is for me and my son is protected and the moon is traveling the news and God is protecting him and his godfather, his dead grandfather, which is like a godfather, is guarding him. I practice belief in my beliefs, in my body, in the yoga, and through the meditation. That's my three ways. Theta, yoga, meditation. To be honest, everybody is telling me, you were always this way, but before the war, you weren't speaking about it that openly. You would say, oh, Maya, the parents consultant. Maya, the couples consultant. Now people say, oh, Maya, the spiritual person that would help you solve your marriage and parental issues. I look at it through what you attract from the world. Word had gave me anxiety and fears that are real fears. My son is actually in danger. I have to practice belief and protection. Otherwise, not only I won't survive, the way I talk to him would make him weaker. And I have two other children looking up to me. The way me and my husband tell them, that's the way they would learn to cope with an unexpected presence or an unwanted presence, because that's what we had to deal with. Times that weren't to our liking, and challenges and fears. And for me, it was really important as a mother and as a consultant, but first of all, as a mother, as a person, to help myself and make sure that my children and my family don't drown with it. And the only remedy I know is hope.
I love that. I do want to, for a second, talk about actually your son's emotional experiences, because he's not only had to experience the torment of combat, but also you shared with me of losing his best friend in essentially the first day of fighting. He's witnessed things that no human should ever have to witness. And you shared with me like a really poignant sentiment that your son expressed after the loss of his best friend. I asked, you know, was he scared? Did he want to leave the war? Would he want to quit? And you said, well, you could tell me what he said. Can you tell me a bit about his emotional experience, not only to the war, but also to specifically this loss of his best friend?
I will start by saying that if you're going to see a picture of my son, it's a blonde, really thin young man, okay? And as a person, he's really strong, full of muscles, but the heart is a really sensitive person, okay? So we speak emotions really openly, both as a family and as a mother and son. So after his best friend was killed on his first day of fighting, I think the world changed for my son. I think the perspective changed. But if I was expecting him to become more sensitive, it made him sensitive to his friend's family, but it made him, his drive became much higher for him. It's like, no, mom, that's my job. I have to go and do it. I have to go and finish it. And my son did things that he's really proud at. He saved people. He saved the guy that died in his arms. It's really tough because this guy was burned. And it's really tough to take out the memory of a smell from someone's body. So he still has the memory of the smell, which would probably stay for life. He was in battle. He knows the outcome of the battle. I have asked him, do you regret? He said, mom, how can you regret fulfilling your job, knowing that if you're not operating first, then he's operating on you first and you're gone. So no, I don't regret. The men, they are not children anymore. The men that are our children, the men that I have raised, had became a sensitive, strong person. This had every Saturday night that he's home, he will go to visit his friend's family. Every Friday when he will arrive, he will buy four bouquets. First bouquet will go to the grandmother, Uliran's mother, who lives really close by. Second bouquet comes to me. Third bouquet goes to his girlfriend's mother, who lives on the second street. He has a 3.5 years of relationship girlfriend. And the fourth bouquet, he goes to the grave to put it for his best friend. No 20 years old young man needs to carry it for life. That's the Israeli way. We are people of hearts. So he has dreams. I have an open relationship with him. I've sent him for talks. I am making his talks with him as a mother, not as a consultant. And I have my finger on that. I think for many years now, I will look from the outside to make sure that his soul is protected. Because I did not send I would cry in the beginning saying, they're making my son a war machine. My son is becoming a war machine. I think this was my biggest worry, that he would lose his soul, that he would lose his sensitivity, that I'm going to have an alive child, but not my child. It will be a machine of a war. And no, I have my son. I have an amazing, amazing, amazing young man showing me day and night what it means to be a Jewish person at 2025, because we have to protect ourselves. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah, it's obvious that he's a man of a very strong moral character. And I remember that you specifically said to me that after the death of his best friend, that he said to you, that fighting is like breathing right now. You don't choose to fight. You
exactly.
Just fight.
Yeah, you choose to live, he said. I choose to live, Mom, and that's the only way I can live now. Because, you know, we have friends who are not Jewish, that we have close friends, and they called me, and they tried to convince me, and they tried to convince him, and I said, don't even try. It's like breathing. And then he said, Mom, it's my life. For us, I look at it, I'm 48 years old. I know what 3 years out of 48 years old means. For him, it's his life. There will not be a country if this age of men are not going to protect us. And men and women, my son is serving in an elite unit that only men serve the battle, but there are units that women serve too in really dangerous positions.
And they choose to.
And they choose
to. Women never have to go to combat unless they choose to.
Yes, and does,
more
and
women
don't.
Are choosing to these days.
Right.
Yeah, unique. Unique. Israel is a very, very unique nation in innumerable ways. But one way is how, as we've touched upon before, Am Yisrael is literally like one big family. I mean, every child is everyone's child, and every hostage is everyone's loved one, and every soldier is a personal hero. And I think that's like one of the reasons why the Jews have survived against all odds from generation to generation. We have a soul level solidarity, perhaps unparalleled anywhere on earth, because we are so small. We're just 16 million people, 1/6 million in a world of 8 billion. We're point.
And we are 8 here and 8 spread in the diaspora. So we are so little.
Yeah, we're 0.02% of the world. It's so funny that people think we're like 1/3 of the world. We're not even 1/5 of 1% of the world.
Nothing.
But because we're so small, like, our unbreakable bond, I think, is our superpower. Maya, I know that you have done some remarkable things, and I wanted to ask, in what ways have you seen beyond the soldiers, beyond the IDF, in what ways have you seen Amisrael come together in this war effort, and in what special ways have you personally contributed?
To be honest, everybody was volunteering wherever you were needed. Okay. So when you have someone at the war, you usually put your energy into something that is close to your heart. So I can tell you that my husband, because my husband is an orphanage of the Israeli army, because he lost his father. So he's really connected into a big unit of the orphanages and the widowers.
Oh.
And they have asked people, sorry for saying it, that know grief to go to each and every Shiva. We had thousands of Shivas. Shiva is the week that we honor every dead soldier or every dead person. We sit for a week with the family. So the army was sending a person, and the union of the orphanage wanted to serve, so we can help you. So my husband was doing that. He was moving from a Shiva to a Shiva. I couldn't do it. And I'm going to be honest and share with you that his amazing mother, my mother-in-law, who wanted to help too, said to him, every place you go, that there is either a commander with a child, like what happened to her, that stayed a widower with children, take me with you. I'll sit with the widower, tell her my story, promise her that life is gonna be okay. So that started to be our beginning. And then I'm looking for what will I do?
Right.
And I started asking, so what are the mothers are doing? What are the fathers are doing? And we started a group of parents that is basically giving the children what they need that the army cannot supply. The army would supply basic food, basic clothes. They would take care of all our needs. I'm not saying that they didn't, but I'll give you an example. Kids are fight kids. They're not kids. They're men, but they're fighting for hours. So when they would come out after 3, 4, 5 weeks, they would say, we would go out, we would be hungry for the whole day, and we would go back only at night when it's dark. And so we were starting to think, okay, what do they have? They have small pockets. So a pocket is this size. So we would make private pieces, single pieces, and we would start to think, how can we put different food and not only the box food? We made, you know what schnitzel challah? You take a challah of a Shabbat challah, you make a kosher schnitzel, you make the things, you make it. Thursday night, you open like 10 kitchens at the same time, you prepare hundreds of them, and then a special unit of soldiers, of warriors, are taking schnitzels. And the schnitzels come in, and then those warriors are taking the pictures, coming out, and you get the picture of those 24 hours you were working, knowing that your son had one hot meal, kosher, prepared. Those are the little things that we did. We started collecting money in order for making the equipment better. For example, they had to wear shades on their eyes because of to protect the eyes. And of course, the shades, the special glasses, they would break. So we would need glasses from the states that are approved in your army. We didn't have them. So how do we get them? Those things the army don't play with. The army has to fight. So we as parents put our efforts to recruit 50 old women in a place. What did they do? Okay, start knitting for us hats. Start. That's the Israeli nation. And to be honest, out of this year and I don't know, 4 months, I've been involved in volunteering like more than 50% of my time, probably until this October. Something around the Lebanon ceasefire had changed the volunteer needs because the angles are different. So for now, less volunteering, more recruiting your energy, thinking, letting them practice, using the ceasefire. For us, also for the parents volunteering. One day, my son is saying, Mom, you're basically you, the parents, not me personally. You, the parents, you run a company. You have a bank account, because everything has to be legit, everything has to be fixed, everything. And when we do it, I do it for at least 30 soldiers or maybe 120 soldiers if it's the whole unit. Okay. You go on numbers that you need. People and you have energy and you need energy. To be honest, you asked me what's my remedy for fear, and I said, belief. That's one way to practice belief. If I deal with the size of the chocolate bar that will not melt in August summer heat in Gaza, that gives me hope because my son is gonna get it. That's how my brain is thinking. That's what makes me feel useful. And that's how I would run my days when I couldn't hear from him. I would send my message through the moon, but the moon didn't send the message back.
Wow, I wanted to ask some questions about Israel post-war, but even more, I like to end these conversations on a high and hopeful note, which I think you actually really just beautifully provided. My hope in doing this show is that listeners have a greater understanding of how much Israeli values and Jewish values really line up with all Western values, how the value of life it supersedes everything. And I know that in a time of war, people can't always reconcile these concepts, but I hope that listening to Maya speak has helped to solidify that. Maya, before we close out the conversation, is there any other hope, any other message that you would like to share with our listeners? I think you already gave a really good one, but
I really hope that if someone, even one person, changes his opinion over what it means for the real people who are fighting, not the media, the real people, then thank you for listening. That's what I want to say because there is no hidden agenda. I'm just one person, one mother, but like me, there are hundreds and thousands of Israeli mothers. Just doing what we're supposed to do. Look at it from protection point of view. We really wait for new days to come. We have no wishful thinking for the war to continue. We just want peace.
amen.
Amen.
May peace prevail. May it come soon, and may it come from all borders. I mean,
Yes.
it's just I think we, Israel is a nation that was built literally on Hatikva, the national anthem. Not
Yeah,
everybody understands that
we
word.
tikva is a hope.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. And thank you for and to your son and to your family and to the whole nation for continuing to carry that torch.
Thank you so much for those words, for seeing it and appreciating it. Thank you.
Yeah. Last three words. Yisrael Chai.
I'm Israel. Hi.